Hello and welcome to the Brentas Foundation podcast, where we throw light on some of the African continent's biggest and most pressing issues and leverage best practice, not just on what to do, but how to do it. I'm your host, Marino Ongoklo, and it's a pleasure to share in this moment with you. If you're new here, welcome. It's nice to have you here. If you're a regular, hey, how's it going? So this is the podcast where I share a lot of the super interesting conversations I have with really cool people. I'm a firm believer in sharing ideas that shape and challenge the world as we know it. My hope is that these conversations, where you get to be a fly on the wall, start further and deeper conversations wherever you are and lead to the exploring of actions and ideas that actually work and make a difference. So without further ado, let's get straight into it. Again, I'm Marie Noel and you're listening to the Brentas Foundation podcast. Joining me today is Isabel Sakok. Isabel is a development practitioner, policy analyst, researcher, and teacher. She's currently a senior fellow at the Policy Center for the New South, where her publications assess agricultural policies and distortions and agricultural transformation from smallholder subsistence to demand-driven commercial farming. Her book, Success in Agricultural Transformation, What It Means and What Makes It Happen, is a must-read for all interested in agriculture as a means of growth and development. Isabel Sakok holds a PhD in economics from Harvard University and a BA in philosophy and economics from the London School of Economics. She's worked in most regions of the developing world, including Africa, north and south of the Sahara, as well as in Asia, the south, southeast and east, and of course in Latin America. Today, Isabel joined me and the topic of discussion was agricultural transformation, what it means, what it takes, what the lessons are, and why Africa is struggling with this. This chat and the manner in which the ideas were communicated is one that I wish I'd been introduced to in high school, for instance. It's the kind of chat that makes the complex simple and the convoluted easy to follow. I hope you enjoy it. And without further ado, here's the product of my conversation with Isabel Sakok. So Isabel Sakok, thank you so much for joining me today. It's an absolute pleasure to have you here. How are you?
I'm really great. Thanks. I really look forward to talking to you.
Likewise. And thank you for your patience in making sure this internet works with us. So a bit of background over here. Isabel and I met in a bus sometime close to midnight in the streets of Morocco after attending an event. And we got to chatting halfway asleep, but halfway fully awake and excited to hear what the other person to say. And one of the topics that we sort of touched on very briefly was this idea of agricultural transformation and its outcomes in Asia and the potential on the continent. And so I thought this would be a great opportunity to have that chat in more depth, but also to take that conversation to more people. And so that's how we ended up here. And I'm truly grateful that you availed yourself to do this. So to get us started, Isabel, maybe we could talk a little bit about, in layman's term, you know, what do we mean by agricultural transformation?
Okay, in layman's terms, it means that your agriculture, which started by being very low productivity, just subsistence farming, is transformed over decades long into an agriculture that is more productive, which means one unit of labor produces a lot more. It has a lot of surplus you want to sell. But more importantly, the life of the farmer and the life of the entire economy is transformed from low productivity, extensive poverty, to high productivity and higher incomes. That's why it's called transformation. It is a transformation that we in developing countries all are looking for. We are all needed and we all want it. This is the first step on development. It really is the first step.
No, that's, yeah, and that's a very helpful way to actually explain it. I've never quite heard it so practically explained. So thank you very much. I think it would be good to hear from your research, right, your experience and expertise over the course of the years. Can you share a little bit about where agricultural transformation has worked well and why it worked at all?
Ah, yeah, that is a subject close to my heart. It has worked well in, look at all the high income industrial countries today. It has worked well in those countries, not only in Europe and North America, but also Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and it is working in many developing countries today. But it's a very long-term process. It worked well in China from 1979 to it's still working. It has worked well in Mauritius, my little island next to you. Oh, well, it's not next to Ghana, but next to South Africa. It has worked well. So it really, the striking thing about this, Marie-Noelle, it has worked well in so few countries of the world. Most of us in developing countries were still mired in a low productivity kind of, what one of my friends said in the bank, hopeless agriculture. It looks like it's hopeless, but it's far from hopeless if we are able to get it moving. You know, there's a famous book by Motion, I think it's 1955. He says, how to get agriculture moving. This is it. We must get agriculture moving. And on that, there's so much literature, but one that I really want to point out is called The Transformation of Traditional Agriculture. It lays it out on what makes agriculture transform. I mean, this has been the subject of not only my research, but of research of so many people, because it is a fascinating prospect. You know, the first country to do this is what country? Is our beloved United Kingdom, England, was the first country to transform its agriculture and its industry. It is no accident that those two came together. And then it was followed by, you know, the other big countries today. But I think for Africans, and, you know, I come from Africa too, but in a little island too, we are frustrated why it doesn't happen there. And okay, you ask for, you know, what can we learn from Asia? There's a lot, but I think I want to identify three important things that happen in the Asian countries that have succeeded and are actually succeeding. Like Malaysia is a country that's really moving. I think Africa, Asia shows the transformative impact of land reform when it is done well. The key word is when it is done well. Now, we can go into what it means by doing well. There's a lot in there. That's another big subject that, you know, your readers may be, your listeners may be interested. But for land reform to be done well, it requires a government that is committed, because this thing takes time, which is what we don't realize. Transformation takes decades. So we need a government that is capable, that is not corrupt, and will put the resources behind it. And I was just reading the latest publication from, this Alliance for Green Revolution in Africa, you know, that AGRA. It points out that a lot of problems in Africa is low government commitment to this thing. It shows that although they agreed to spend 10% of their public expenditure in agriculture, at some point it was 4.5%, but has gone way down to 2%. And anyway, they are really sounding the alarm. So it requires enormous commitment in terms of staff power and in terms of administration and in terms of resources. And then the third thing that it requires is, when I say land reform done right, it requires a land administration system that works, which means what? It means when you own a piece of land, Marie-Noëlle, you know you own it. You know, you have tenure security. You can show it in court. You see, it's only when you have that kind of legal security, you can use it as a collateral. It is no accident that financing is a typical problem of small farmers. They have no land, they have no tenure security, they have nothing to call to their name. Who wants to lend money to poor people? I mean, you have microfinance, yes, but that doesn't transform, as Bangladesh will show you. It does not. It keeps me alive. I'm not against it. It's very clear that people don't misunderstand me, but it does not transform. And you can see it. I mean, just look at it. It helps people, and I'm for anything that helps people, I am for, whether it transforms them or not. But if we're talking of transformation, and I think Africa needs and wants to transform, and right now you have a historic opportunity in your African Continental Free Trade Agreement. You have a huge market, but it will not help unless governments are committed and put the money. And this is said by Africans themselves. It's said by the, you know, AU. It's said by, you know, UNICA, which is the African.
Everyone, yeah.
Yeah, it's said by everybody. It's not a secret. It's well known.
Mm-hmm.
Governments must believe in agriculture enough to put the resources behind it and to keep putting on the resources. And the reason why it's so critical, Marie-Noëlle, is because of climate change. Climate change is very, very harsh. It's changing the climate. So, you know, what my grandfather used to do that was great in his little farm is no longer any good to me. The whole thing is changing, and water is becoming a huge stressor. And if we don't do anything, by we, I mean not only Africa, but the whole world, and we allow this climate to keep on warming, the yields, you know, we're talking of higher productivity, which means one unit of land or one unit of labor produces a lot more. Our yields are actually going to go down because the climate has changed. So, you know, in the words of many, and I've looked at a lot of African publication on this, they all sound the alarm. This is urgent, urgent, urgent. We must transform agriculture. You know, we say, oh, Africa must industrialize, but you won't be able to industrialize without a proper transform agriculture. No country has done it. And if you look into the, you know, the mechanics of what happened, which I'm not going to go into, but you can easily see, easily by, you know, the whole literature talks about it, why it is so that if you don't have an agriculture with continuous surplus to feed we city people, you know, where are we going to eat? More and more people depend on a highly productive agriculture. Unless we have that, we cannot move. We are totally bogged down. So I would say what Africa can learn from Asia is, because Asia has enormous poverty too. Asia was on the brink. But yeah. Asia has been able to get the Green Revolution. Africa must have its Green Revolution. It will be different, because when you look at different countries, Marie-Noëlle, What is striking is everybody gets there in a different way, but there are patterns of things that do work and things that don't work. And that's why we can learn from each other, which doesn't mean we have to just do what the other does, because that is not going to work, because our country is different. But there are so many things. I think what Africa can learn and should learn from Asia is really the transformative impact of land reform done right. Land reform has been done in many countries. You know, South Africa tried it, Brazil tried it, I don't know, endless. Iran tried it, and it's a flop, and it's horrible. It doesn't help people. Mexico tried it, and you can see all the ways it doesn't work. It's a very demanding thing, but when it's done right, it totally changes the world for you. And for it to be done
Isabel,
right,
can you
must be committed.
Can you talk a bit about, yeah, no, I think I wanted to get to this idea of done right, right? What is it that, I like to think of Africa as not particularly extraordinary or exceptional, but what is it that we are missing that maybe they got right in other places like Asia? And how we say commitment, but how were they able to, do you have any insights on how they were able to gain or gather some of these types of commitments and stick to it over the years? And what maybe we are failing to do, either as private sector, as either as civil society, or even people sort of in government?
Okay, let me take one country. I take Taiwan, yeah, because it's not charged. It's not China. It's not Japan. It's not South Korea. But they actually followed more or less the same thing. But you take the case of Taiwan. Taiwan was under Japanese occupation for 50 years, okay? And then it was taken after the end of the war when Japan was defeated, it became Chinese. Then it was taken over by the nationalist government. Now, this is another big geopolitical brouhaha that I won't get into. Let's look at their land reform. When you say, what did they get right? It was absolutely existential for them to get the land reform right. Why? Because they didn't want the communists to be breathing down their throat. They knew if they did it wrong, the communists would say, well, you see, you can't. The poverty in Taiwan was incredible, was really high. They were under Japanese occupation, and then they've gone through the war, and you know what the war does to all of us, it flattens us. So when they started, okay, one is, which is a very important thing, they did get enormous American help. You do need a lot of finance for that.
Yeah.
But when you look at the American help, and I can send you the book that goes into great big detail, I just send it to you so you can look at it yourself, is very little of that American help was actually used for land reform. So when I say it costs a lot of money, I mean land reform must be looked at in an economy-wide change, which a lot of us don't realize. You can't just go and fiddle with the land alone. For land to become a valuable asset, it has to be put in an overall economy that's moving. That's number one. You have to look at land reform as one key component, essential component of transforming a whole society. That's one. Number two, they did it in a way, you know, They really, first, I think it was not corrupt, which I think is so important. Now, why it wasn't corrupt, there's plenty of books on it, which is fascinating, but I won't go into it. But both the Americans that were giving the aid and the Chinese that worked, they had their feet to the fire. You know, commitment, often it's fear, unfortunately. Fear does work sometimes. They fear if they fail, could be the end of that. So they then did the technical parts of it. Was really amazing what they did. This is what I call administration. I'd have to be really capable. You know, they surveyed the land, they broke it, they really make it into what is called unimodal distribution. You know, it was highly unequal. And you see, land in South Africa is highly unequal. Land in most of Africa is highly unequal too. Land in a lot of developing world is highly unequal, even in India. You can look at India. It was not done well, in my view. But we won't go into that. Let's go into what they... Then they had it in different stages. The first stage is what they call rent reduction. They had a system in which everybody who was a tenant to a big landlord there had their rent reduced. And how did they reduce it? It was not arbitrary. They tried to figure out what could that land produce, what was the value, what could the rent, what should the rent be given this production? And then they imposed it. That's what I call a government commitment. It is not the way, and you know I come from the World Bank, but it's not the way the World Bank does it, which I am totally against, what they call market-assisted land reform. It has not worked. It's a huge disagreement among bank people about where it has worked, why. But basically, it hasn't worked. It has been tried in South Africa. It has been tried in Brazil. And you can look at all those things. It's public knowledge. So it was not market-assisted. It was entirely technocratic. First, they reduced the rent and imposed it. Second, which I think is brilliant, they did not treat landlords like evil people that their heads have to be chopped. No. They gave them, and I think this is important, land reform is often viewed too much like we're going to get those wicked guys out. That's not the issue. Yeah. They may be wicked, they may not be wicked, but that is irrelevant to development. It's irrelevant. They gave them bonds in industry that was owned by government. So immediately, and I think I haven't seen it in any other land reform. Immediately, the landlords shifted their economic interest to industry. You see, they just moved them. It was not, so they got something that was considered fair. They got it. And they were afraid of inflation, of all that money, you know, when there was no production. You know, the place was totally devastated, no production. They were in long bonds. It was in industry. It was in terms of rice. It was in terms of sweet potatoes. You see, so the way you compensate the losers is critical. This is the important thing about land reform. How you compensate the losers and you make them winners in a different economic system. You can't just put their heads off. You know, those guys, you may not like them, but they are pretty clever people. After all, they are very rich. After all, they became, you know. So I think this is another thing we in developing countries must admit. Even the people, quote, we don't like because we think they are too rich, they have a lot of things they can bring to the economy. So losers must be compensated in a way that make them winners in the new economy. That, to me, is the key thing of what they did right. So immediately those guys shifted. So they were not interested in fighting the government. They said, okay, great. They saw that there was nothing they could do because both America and the new government were bent on having a land reform. So this is the second thing they did right. The third thing, which is often forgotten about land reform, and I take the case of Mexico, you can look into that, you know, the Ejido reform. where they you give those poor people or you sell the land to them. You see, the way they sold it was also very clever. It was not go to the private bank. You know, no private bank want to deal with poor people. We should just realize that and not say, well, the private sector didn't do anything. Well, they can. I mean, you can't expect the private bank to go bankrupt. I mean, what good is that? The government held the loan, and the government held a very long-term loan. I mean, this is actually what's done in Singapore too. This is a different subject, not land reform, but on housing. But it's the same principle. You hold very long-term loans for the poor. See, that's why I say it needs to be a long-term affair. It's not a today, tomorrow affair.
Right, yeah.
And the third major component of a land reform done right is you have to put in place infrastructure and a policy that makes that land actually valuable. Well, I used to say to my colleagues in Ejido reform, they just gave people a piece of land, and I say, it's just for me to dig my grave in. There's no point giving me a pile of rocks, Marie-Noël. You have to put in, you know.
That is true.
Yeah, you have to put in the infrastructure, and that is what a lot of the African people, you know, who write about it are just screaming at the top of their voices, you know, bring the infrastructure, bring, there's so much government can do and should do. Now, when you say that, people say, oh, well, we're going to get the money. Well, you know, okay, Taiwan had a ton of money. That I'm not going to but they used it well. That is the critical thing. They used it well. In Africa, and I was looking at the publications of UNICA, it has a publication on illicit financial flows. How much does Africa lose because so much money is stolen from the African people in terms of, you know, tax fraud, misinvoicing, plain corruption. And it is, according to the latest report I could find, you know, the report of the, and, you know, I can send you this and you can look at it yourself. It's not private knowledge at all. The 2015 document, they say it's an, of course, that has to be an estimate. Because money that goes under the table is money that goes under the table.
You know? Exactly, yeah.
But to publish it, you know, was 50 billion. They say it's a conservative estimate, but we think it's at least 50 billion. And then in 2020, you see another update of that. It says it's at least 88 billion. So my point is Africa and even, you know, and I like to look at the publications of AU, of, you know, of AGRA, of, there's so much good publication that comes out of Africa that I think they are ignoring completely. It's just tragic. I think it's tragic. You know, they say Africa should figure a proper taxation system. You have a highly inequitable economic system. I mean, look at it in the broad terms, highly inequitable system. Land is highly inequitably put. I mean, the land tenure situation in most of sub-Saharan Africa is a mess. The only country that tried to change it is Rwanda and Ethiopia. And you can see what difference it makes. It has made a huge difference to Rwanda that were devastated by the genocide. They still could make something, you know, so that we cannot hide. My point is we Africans or we from developing countries cannot hide by saying, oh, we don't have the money, oh, this. No. We do, and, you know, Africa is the continent that has the most mineral resources. But who is benefiting from it? That is the question.
Mm.
So
yeah, that part.
A lot of transformation works when you view it as an inclusive process, that little people, the majority of people, will benefit from it. So long and you're willing to stick there and make it work. You know, there is no new policy recommendation. When you look at all the literature from 55 to today, I mean, it changes the emphasis. Now it's climate change, now it's water scarcity, now it's, you know, the war in Ukraine, and, you know, crises are different, true. But when you look at basically what is being advocated, it's the same. It's the same thing. So I would say, you know, there is a famous book, and I'm going to send it to you, Marie-Noël, so you can look at it, or you can ask people to look at it, that has been written about. It's actually from a former colleague of mine. His view is, and he's documented it, is unless we solve, he's talking about Africans, we solve this problem of land, its inequity, the incredibly messy legal system around it, we're not going to get out of the gate. And this very harsh, but I think correct message has been repeated again. It's been repeated by a publication by ASSET, you know, the Agricultural Center for Economic Transformation, African Center for Economic Transformation. Yeah, actually, it starts in Ghana, ASSET. You know,
yeah,
about
based out of Accra. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Actually, I did meet with the people there, and we had discussions about that. What I'm telling you, Marie-Noël, is not my invention. It's nothing new I found. It's something African intellectuals and anybody who looks at it has said it over and over again. But my fear is it's falling on deaf ears. I mean, even I was just surprised, but not surprised to see that even Agra is saying, this is urgent. We better get on with it. And they put as one key thing, land. You see, African small farmers have enormous constraints. Actually, it would have been a miracle if they were not so poor. Land is a mess, okay? Water, they cannot control water. It's rain-fed. Irrigation is like, I saw in Southern Africa, at most is 7%. And even that 7%, a lot of the systems are not working. If you can control land, you cannot control water, you cannot access markets, you don't have information, what can you do? Just think about it. You can't do much. I mean, that they are surviving is a great miracle already. We don't want that. So I'm saying, you know, whatever you can do to put focus on this key problem. And it really is, as Peter Timmer always says, and this is based on literature, on evidence, it's not wishful thinking. No country has succeeded in their industrialization without a prior or at least simultaneous agricultural revolution. None.
Yeah.
And that is really something critical. And I see it's repeated in the African publications too. It's not, you know, the minority view. It's not nothing like that. It's not a revolutionary view. It is, but it's a view that seems to be ignored. And I think with the historic opportunity Africa has of the free trade, please let us not drop that too.
That brings us to the end of today's show. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did putting it together. I love learning new things. Hey, if you enjoyed this chat, you definitely enjoy others that came before it. Check out previous episodes on whichever platform you're tuned into now, or visit our website www.thebrenthurstfoundation.org for other episodes. As always, thank you so much for listening, and if I could make one last ask of you, please do share this with others. Again, you're listening to Marie Noel on the Brenthurst Foundation podcast, and it's been a pleasure sharing this time with you. Until next week, stay well.